I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last night, President Barack Obama and Mitt Romney met for their third and final debate focusing on foreign policy. They discussed Libya, the civil war in Syria, Iran's nuclear program, Israel, military spending, drones, although President Obama dodged that question, U.S. relations with China and Afghanistan. Other than the issue of military spending, there were very few differences. Both candidates expressed unconditional support for Israel and, quote, crippling sanctions on Iran. And Mitt Romney said he agreed with the president's drone program. So on today's Your Call, we are having a discussion about last night's debate and the future of U.S. foreign policy. Where is it heading? What about the issues that were not discussed last night? What about Africa and Latin America and the rest of Asia and the European Union? If you watched the debate, what did you think? What questions would you have asked? And what would a real debate, one with substance on U.S. foreign policy, actually look like? We'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. Today, we're joined by Muin Rabbani. He's an independent Middle East analyst based in Amman, Jordan, and contributing editor to the Middle East Report. And Muin joins us from Amman. Hi, Muin. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. To be here.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Mansour Farhang, professor of international relations at Bennington College in Vermont. Hi, Mansour. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have both of you. So first off, I'd love to get your reaction to last night's presidential debate. Andrew Leonard in Salon wrote a piece called A Debate to Be Ashamed Of, A Progressive Nightmare. On drones, Israel, and Iran, the candidates presented a united hardline front. Mansour, let's start off with you. What was your overall assessment of last night?
It was more of a discussion between two people who fundamentally agreed with each other than a debate on issues that at least they had some differences. Obama continued to defend the policies that he has been putting in place since he came to office, and Romney retreated from the positions he took during the primary or even after the Republican primaries and ended up to simply echo President Obama's position. There was very little difference, and it is hard to call it a debate.
And Muin, what's your assessment?
Yeah, I have to agree. I mean, according to my limited knowledge of the English language, a debate is where you have a proposition and one person agrees and the other person disagrees with that proposition, or at least you have two people lining up on, you know, identifiably different sides of one or more issues. There was absolutely none of that yesterday. At best, there was some discussion about, you know, who would do more of this or who would do more of that, but the idea that that either candidate would do anything differently have a fundamentally different approach to these issues, or even raise entirely different issues than the ones that were on that are on the agenda, just didn't arise in the least.
I thought this comment from President Obama's spokeswoman, Jen Psaki, really said a lot. She said, quote, "I know that Mitt Romney tried to offer his endorsement of virtually everything President Obama did, and we accept his endorsement." Mansour, what do you make of that statement?
But that is generally the case. Even if, when he criticized President Obama for not supporting the Green Movement demonstrations in Iran in 2009, it was based on a completely false assumption. The Green Movement was being accused by the Iranian regime of being complicit with American position, with Western position, and the leaders and advocates of the Green Movement resisted this accusation and wanted to prove their independence. And therefore, they did not want the United States to come out and support the Green Movement because it would have discredited the movement. So what Romney is suggesting Obama should have done, it was really against the interest and preferences of the people who were involved in the Green Movement. In its very specific sense, he is talking to an audience, assuming that the American people or the listeners do not know anything about the situation, and therefore is accusing President Obama based on a false assumption that has absolutely nothing to do with reality.
Well, and they were both trying to outdo each other about who can impose more crippling sanctions on Iran.
Exactly. For example, these sanctions are directed against the Iranian people. Overwhelming majority of the people in Iran are opposed to the sanctions, while at the same time they despise their own regime. So there is no evidence that these sanctions are going to lead to any kind of flexibility on the part of the Iranian regime, while these sanctions are causing a great deal of pain and suffering in the society at large. As a progressive, as a liberal, I expected a question at least be raised, if not a response from Romney or Obama, at least the question be raised on what basis the suffering of the Iranian people is going to contribute to the resolution of the nuclear crisis.
Well, and that angle isn't really getting much attention at all about how the sanctions are affecting ordinary people. The Guardian had a good piece on this and started off by talking about a woman who takes a pill twice a day in her home. It's the difference between life and death. And she contacted her friend in the U.S. to say she was running out of the medicine due to the shortage. And to the dismay of this woman, the order was rejected because of U.S. sanctions. But we're really not having a conversation about how these sanctions are affecting average people. And even children are not getting access to medicine in Iran.
Yeah, not at all. A good example just to demonstrate to show the truth of what you were saying was the sanctions imposed on Saddam Hussein and Iraq, that Saddam Hussein continued to sell oil secretly and have enough money for the regime and for his family and for his friends, but the Iraqi people suffered immensely, and the records are really incredible how many children died as a result of these sanctions. More or less the same thing is happening or could happen in Iran if these sanctions continue, with the general expectation that they could make a difference in the position of the regime. That is extremely unlikely.
And we have an email from Butler in San Francisco who says there was a difference between the candidates regarding a, quote, nuclear Iran. Romney talked about a, quote, nuclear capable, and Obama specifically mentioned a nuclear bomb. Israeli generals in agreement that Iran does not have one, that everyone is watching progress toward one, and essentially a red line if Iran is determined to be close to one. He goes on to say Romney's phrase is essentially Netanyahu's and a much lower threshold for war or intervention. What are your thoughts on that?
It can be interpreted as lower threshold for military action, but it's ambiguous enough to be extended, you know, indefinitely if, for whatever reason, the decision is made to continue the sanctions and there is no evidence that Iran is moving toward making the bomb. It's the question of capability or having the bomb is really more of a matter of linguistic difference and a policy difference. Both of them are opposed to containment. Both of them say Iran cannot continue the continuation of enrichment of uranium without a military response from the United States. If enrichment of uranium is the basis of capability to make nuclear bombs, there are over 35 signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Did we just lose you, Mansour? I think we lost him. Muin, do you want to jump in there? What would you add to that?
Well, I mean, not much. I generally agree with what was said. There was no discussion, for example, of whether the current approach to Iran is, you know, even within the narrow framework of U.S. national interests, let alone, you know, just put aside for a moment the rights of people in the region, whether this is the best approach in terms of serving U.S. national interests, or whether this is really a policy that's by and large pandering to a foreign power, namely Israel. You know, there's a much more important question, which is not just, you know, whether or not the U.S. should go to war with Iran if Iran goes nuclear or becomes nuclear capable, but whether in fact these sanctions could themselves lead to a conflict, an accidental, or deliberate one.
And that is Muin Rabbani. He's an independent Middle East analyst based in Amman, Jordan, contributing editor to the Middle East Report. We have Mansour Farhang back. He's a professor of international relations at Bennington College. And Butler, thank you for your email. And you can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also give us a call, 866-798-8255. Last night was the third and final debate focusing on U.S. foreign policy, although on many cases, Mitt Romney tried to change the discussion and bring it back to domestic policies, talking about everything from Mali to Poland to his love for teachers and job creation. I mean, he put at least 10 different topics in a 3-minute soundbite. So what were your thoughts on the debate last night? It's getting a lot of criticism because the candidates really did sound similar on so many issues other than military spending. So what questions would you have asked, and what would a real debate on U.S. foreign policy look like, one with substance? 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. So, Mansour, because there is a consensus about the fact that these candidates agreed on so many important issues, what would a real debate on U.S. foreign policy look like?
I think a real debate should begin with the recognition of reality that the Middle Eastern region is going through sea change in every country, and the United States has very limited capability to influence the situation. That if we are going to have democratic societies in the Middle Eastern countries, we are going to have a far greater and more significant, more powerful anti-Israeli expansionism in the Middle East region. The United States cannot support Israeli expansionism unconditionally and at the same time expect to have normal relationship with democratically elected leaders in the Middle East. The only conceivable way the United States could be an unconditional backer of Israeli expansionism and refusal to negotiate with Palestinians and at the same time have good relationship with Arab states is support dictators, as the United States has been doing for the past 56 years. So this is the beginning of a discussion, and both sides seem to refuse to recognize that reality, that the world is changing and American foreign policy assumptions have to go through a serious reconsideration.
And Muin, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, both candidates announced over and over their full and unconditional support for Israel. Palestine was not mentioned. And what's really interesting here is that Israel-Palestine has been a major foreign policy issue for past administrations, but it seems in the last year or so, it's been almost dropped from the Obama administration. What explains this?
Well, I'd first like to get back to your earlier point, and I completely agree. The region is going through a sea change, and it was somewhere between laughable and obscene to listen to the two candidates talk about their not only their support for democracy in the Arab world in the Middle East, but that actually U.S. intervention is somehow required to secure this democracy. I think, you know, the historical and factual record speaks for itself, which is that the U.S., despite being a leading democracy within its own borders, has actually been a primary obstacle to democracy in the Middle East. And you know, the reality is that not only is the United States an adversary of Arab democracy, but it's also the case that democracy in the Arab world is in many respects inimical to U.S. national interests as they've been traditionally defined in terms of oil and so on. And so the real question that should have been posed is, now that this region is undergoing a transformation that's, you know, whether through parliamentary democracies or other forms, is going to produce greater popular input into policy formulation. And Dr. Farhang mentioned greater hostility to Israel as one consequence, and there will be others too. For example, demands for greater national control of resources such as oil and so on. How is the U.S. going to accommodate this trend, and how is it going to deal with societies that can no longer be controlled through, you know, a king here and a dictator and an autocrat there. So that issue wasn't really discussed, and instead we just listened to two candidates pat themselves on the back for somehow having pioneered this democratic transformation in the Middle East, which in fact they've worked for decades to try to stop and are still working to try to stop in places like Bahrain and elsewhere. Now, in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I don't see how there could have been a debate between the two candidates on this issue, because there's nothing that they disagree on in this respect. U.S. policy towards this conflict has become one of unconditional and uncritical support for Israel. We've now gotten to the point where every time Israel engages in the construction of a new settlement, it's not even noted for the record anymore by the State Department spokesman. In previous administrations, you know, I'm thinking, for example, of the Reagan administration, which was known as one of the most pro-Israeli American administrations ever. But still, it was, you know, considered a serious issue when Israel would engage in kind of this rapid settlement expansion. Even the previous administration of George W. Bush always made a point of at least making an anodyne statement about the latest Israeli act of settlement expansion. Under Obama, it's not even mentioned anymore. You know, it's just taken for granted. And I think this is emblematic of the general development of U.S. policy in the region. And I think the conclusion is that the U.S. actually, the proper role for the U, or the actual role of the U.S. has not been one of seeking to forge a peace agreement, but it is in fact a primary obstacle to the prospect for Middle East peace. And furthermore, that Middle East peace is only going to become a realistic prospect when an alternative framework that very substantially reduces the U.S. role and influence on conflict resolution is found and agreed.
And we have a comment from a listener who wanted you to come to react to Jimmy Carter's recent statement that Netanyahu has given up on pursuing a Palestinian state, and said that every previous prime minister of Israel has pursued a two-state solution. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I don't think that the historical or factual record bears that out at all. I mean, Israel occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip in 1967, and every Israeli prime minister since has, in fact, avidly pursued what the Israelis often themselves refer to, or at least Israeli commentators, as the creeping annexation of the occupied territories. In other words, a process whereby the prospects for an end to occupation and independent Palestinian statehood are increasingly diminished. Having said that, I think it's also important to recognize that that this specific statement. I think there were two partial exceptions. The first was Yitzhak Rabin, the Israeli Prime Minister, who signed the Oslo Accords. And he was apparently prepared to countenance some form of Palestinian entity. But, you know, we're talking about something that is way short of a state as, let's say, any thinking, observing human being would recognize. It was more or less, you know, a subordinate protectorate and only parts of the occupied territories that Yitzhak Rabin was prepared to countenance. But we never got even that, because he was assassinated by a radical right-wing Israeli. The other is Ariel Sharon, who removed settlements and military bases from within the Gaza Strip, but A, he did so without actually ending the occupation of the Gaza Strip, and B, he did so precisely in order to be able to consolidate Israeli control of the West Bank and East Jerusalem, much the way that his predecessor Begin withdrew from occupied Egyptian Sinai Peninsula during the Carter administration in order to consolidate Israel's hold on the occupied occupied Palestinian territory.
We've got several emails and a few phone calls, so I just want to get to a call before we go to break. Let's hear from Michael in Santa Cruz. Michael wanted to know about the drone question, so we're going to play a clip from last night's debate about drones. And I have to say, Twitter was on fire. Everyone was saying, are they going to ask about drones? Is he going to ask about drones? And he finally did. Here's the clip.
Let me ask you, Governor, because we know President Obama's position on this. What is your position on the use of drones?
Well, I believe that we should use any and all means necessary to take out people who pose a threat to us and our friends around the world. And it's widely reported that drones are being used in drone strikes, and I support that entirely and feel the president was right to up the usage of that technology and believe that we should continue to use it to continue to go after the people who represent a threat to this nation.
And President Obama actually dodged the question on drones. He didn't even say the word drones. Mansour, what were your thoughts on that part of the debate?
But I expected Romney to say exactly what he said, but I expected Bob Schieffer to say, what about the civilians being killed by the drones? And there is overwhelming evidence, and many more civilians are being killed by these drones than the targeted individuals. You know, from a military point of view, they can continue to argue that they're hitting the enemy, but in reality, they're making life for the civilian population of the area miserable and killing many of them. Regrettably, even Bob Schieffer did not raise that question. He simply raised the question in a general abstract sense, and the answers were quite expected and anticipated.
And there have been protests in Pakistan just a couple of weeks ago. Hundreds marched in Pakistan. A U.S. delegation also traveled there to march with Pakistanis to protest the drone attacks. And on that question of the moderator, we have an email from Kevin who says that the debate was missing a journalist. The two candidates in last night's corporate-sponsored debate sounded the same because they're part of the same system, which has sold itself out to the Warren idea that U.S. military dominance is an economic driver for prosperity. But they can't say that to the citizenry. If there was a journalist moderating the debates, they would call this out when they see it emerging as a strategy being promoted by the candidates. The conversation might lean towards truth. Thanks to Democracy Now!'s expanding the debate effort to show Rocky Anderson and Jill Stein, that was excellent. And if you missed that, Democracy Now! Presses pause after the candidates answer the question and then have Rocky Anderson and Jill Stein answer. And they definitely did offer many, many differences. Muin, before we go to break, do you have any final some comments on the drone question?
Well, I'd probably rather be the victim of a drone strike than have to listen, you know, to their vapid droning once again. I mean, like I said, you know, I haven't watched any of the debates. I did watch this one because you asked me to.
Thank you.
And it wasn't a pleasant experience.
Well, thank you for watching. That's Maureen Rabbani, an independent Middle East analyst, joining us from Amman, Jordan. We're also joined by Mansour Farhang, professor of international relations at Bennington College in Vermont. And we'd love to hear from you. If you were disappointed with the debate last night, what would a real debate on U.S. foreign policy look like? What questions were not asked? What countries were missing? 866-798-8255. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
Every Tuesday, the Your Call team sends out their weekly email newsletter that keeps all of us up to date on what's coming up on the show and gives resources so we can all learn more and get involved. Subscribe today so you'll know what's coming up and you can submit your questions and comments before the show even goes to air. It's free and easy to sign up. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. You can also join today's program by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. On tomorrow's show, we'll have a conversation about the new documentary, The Waiting Room, which is about a day in the life of Oakland's Highland Hospital. What does the reality of our public hospitals, the last resort for so many who are poor and uninsured, tell us about our healthcare system? If you've spent any time at Highland or any other public hospital or emergency room, we'd love to hear about your experience on tomorrow's show. And then on Thursday, we are going to talk about the school lunch program and efforts to make it healthier. Today, we are talking about last night's third and final debate focusing on foreign policy. The first question, again, was about Libya. The candidates also talked about the civil war in Syria, Iran's nuclear program, sanctions on Iran, Israel, military spending, U.S. relations with China. There was no talk about, for example, Latin America, the rest of Asia, Africa, and we're actually trying to get a journalist on Friday to talk about why Latin America has been mostly ignored in this campaign. And we'd love to hear from you. What did you think of the debate last night? What questions would you have asked? What facts would you have brought to the table? And what would a real debate on U.S. foreign policy look like? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment on our website or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Maureen Rabbani is an independent Middle East analyst based in Amman, Jordan, and contributing editor to the Middle East Report. Mansour Farhang is professor of international relations at Bennington College in Vermont. And in a couple minutes, we'll be joined by the nation's Mark Hertzgaard, who was hoping that climate change would have been brought up last night, but it wasn't. We'll talk to him about that. Before we do, let's hear from William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. In contradistinction to what many other people may feel, I derived a great deal from this debate and as well as from the previous debates. That which I derived from them is that the only way to influence the political structure is, particularly in states like California or even Texas, where the outcome of the presidential election is foretold, that we should vote for the Green Party, because that way we can communicate to the parties the kinds of policies that we wish them to pursue if they would like in the future to have our votes.
Well, thank you. We have a related comment from Carlton in San Francisco who says, thank you for covering these topics. The question is, what do we do about it? For decades, the Democrats have been trying to out Republicans and their so-called opponents, and now it is more glaringly obvious than ever that there is no substantial difference between the two corporate candidates who admit they agree on virtually everything, especially regarding how the U.S. will continue to target Iran and support Israel. Now, what are we supposed to do about this? I'll bet in spite of this situation, most of your listeners will endorse Barack Obama. Well, actually, we had a meeting about this very question yesterday, and we are going to do a show about who you're supporting. Are you going to support President Obama? Are you going to support a third-party candidate? And we're going to have that conversation during election week. So thank you for those thank you for the call, William, and thank you for the email, Carlton. And now I would like to welcome Mark Hertzgaard to the show. He is a fellow at the New America Foundation, the nation's environmental correspondent, and author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Hi, Mark. Welcome back.
Hi, Rose. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. So a lot of people on Facebook are talking about the fact that the climate was not brought up in last night's debate. What's your overall assessment of the debate?
I think this debate really showed once again just how narrow-minded the Washington consensus is and how that's a consensus, ideological consensus, that's shared not just by the two major political parties, but also by, I'm sorry to say, our colleagues in the mainstream media. Not to say that the questions that were raised weren't important. Obviously, Iran's important. Obviously, Libya and so forth. But for a while there, I was thinking, man, are they going to talk about anything else but Israel?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, no, they did not mention climate change, which is, you know, you mentioned that there's a lot of people on Twitter now and the social media talking about that. It's worth pointing out, this is the first time, last night was the first time since 1988 that climate change has gone completely unmentioned in the presidential and vice presidential debates in this country. Every other 4 years, it has been. Why? Because it is certainly one of the most important issues facing humanity. If you listen to The Economist magazine, they wrote last year that 100 years from now, pretty much the only question that will matter looking back is whether we did anything about climate change or not. But you sure wouldn't know that from the debate last night.
Well, we just got an email from Helena who says, I wish they had addressed climate change, which is perhaps the most important foreign policy issue. And thousands of people gathered outside the provincial parliament in Victoria, British Columbia on Monday to protest a massive oil pipeline. We also have all of the protests and arrests happening because of Keystone, which is also a foreign policy issue. So why do you think, Mark, that this issue has not been raised?
Again, I think it has to do with the fact that the Washington Press Corps does not think of this as a real top-tier foreign policy issue. Candy Crowley, for example, in the second debate, Candy Crowley of CNN, who, by the way, I thought did a really quite a good job just as a journalist to sort of keep these politicians on their toes and keep the conversation moving. But afterwards, she was asked, you know, why didn't you talk about other issues? And she said, well, I did get those emails from you climate people. You climate people. Very revealing phrase, because it indicates that in her mind, and I think it's a perfect reflection of the Washington Press Corps, that climate change is somehow this special interest. It's this kind of sideshow that a certain number of activist types get all worked up about, but it doesn't really rise to the level of a serious foreign policy issue. And so when you've got that kind of a dismissive attitude, and frankly, when you also have two candidates, one of whom, Mr. Romney, essentially says that climate change isn't real, and the other of whom, Mr. Obama, who doesn't talk about climate change himself as a president or as a candidate very much, it's not surprising that the topic goes unmentioned.
Well, and when Romney did bring it up, he wanted to elicit laughs by saying, what did he say, something like, the president is going to make sure the oceans don't rise.
Right.
And people laughed.
Well, that was in his closing at the Republican National Convention. That was during a set speech. And he mocked the idea of caring about climate change and got a big laugh from the crowd. Now, of course, since then, he is cutting way back to the center. Last night, he very clearly was seen speaking to the center, trying to get votes from the center. I mean, most of what he said in the first half of the debate was, yes, me too, whatever President Obama just said, you know. So he's not going to be repeating that stuff about climate change, but he wasn't put on the spot about it either. You know, why didn't Bob Schieffer say, Governor Romney, all of the scientists in the world, all the scientific academies in the world say that climate change is real. Our own Pentagon has said that it's a national security threat. Why don't you believe it's a national security threat?
What else would you have asked, Mark, and what do you think a real debate on U.S. foreign policy would look like or should look like?
Well, I think the journalists should be asking more pointed questions. I felt like last night Bob Schieffer was kind of back to the Jim Lehrer approach, and they both are of that old generation where you just sort of ask an open-ended question, well, what do you think about Syria? Well, frankly, at this point in the campaign, all that does is give these two very professional politicians a chance to roll out their stump speech one more time. If you haven't heard that stump speech by now, you know, don't bother. What you can do and should have done, I would have asked that question to Romney and to President Obama on climate. I would have said, President Obama, last year, on the night that you were elected, you identified three of the major issues you would face as president as being the two wars that were underway, the worst economic collapse since the Great Depression, and, as you put it, quote, a planet in peril, referencing climate change. Last night, Rose, if you noticed, he kept the three that he mentioned in his closing statement were the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the worst financial collapse since the Great Depression, and, not climate change, record deficits. Mm. That tells you a lot about where the political debate has shifted in Washington in particular over the last 4 years.
Well, we've got a caller on climate change, so let's hear from Kathleen in San Francisco. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Well, I just wanted to say that Obama is also totally enthralled to the corporations, and climate change isn't an issue that the corporations approve of discussing, because it would mean they would have to do some things. And so also I wanted to say that Rocky from the Justice Party did mention it. He's deplored the fact that it wasn't brought up.
Right. In fact, they both, Rocky Anderson and Jill Stein, both talked about this last night. Mark, last time you were on the show, you said you did not favor third party candidates. What are your thoughts about last night's debate? Because Democracy Now! Has Rocky Anderson and Jill Stein commenting and responding to the very questions. And, wow, it sure would have been a different debate if Jill Stein and Rocky Anderson or any of the third party candidates were included last night.
No doubt. I hope I didn't say that I don't favor third-party candidates in general. I think what I tried to say was that at this point and under this political system, it's a little late 2 weeks or 4 weeks before an election to try and build a third-party candidacy in a way that has meaning. If you're going to be serious about doing that, you've got to be working years and years in advance to build a movement, to change the eligibility requirements, to change a lot of different rules at the state level. It's too late now to do anything more than a protest vote. And frankly, I don't see the point of a protest vote. We do not, at least in the U.S., you know, winner-take-all political system, it's going to be one party or the other.
And not even in California?
Well, I was going to say, now, because of another very bizarre thing about our political system, the Electoral College. In many states, if you feel like, you know, the outcome is a foregone conclusion, and certainly the political pros on both sides feel that way about California or, you know, for that matter, about North Dakota or Georgia, you know, there a protest vote, I suppose, has more validity or at least less downside risk. That's a different matter, I think, though, than trying to get a real debate going last night. And I think that as much as I think that Jill Stein and Rocky Anderson have very interesting and valuable things to say, you don't need that to have a real debate. You had a journalist on stage. If the journalist does his or her job, you can have a real debate. All it takes is putting really pointed questions to the two candidates and not letting them wiggle around. And as I say, I think Candy Crowley did a pretty good job of that on the second debate, even though she was quite blind on the climate issue.
All right. Well, Mark, before we let you go, what are your thoughts also just about the fact that they ignored so many parts of the world, Canada, Latin America, Africa, other parts of Asia? I mean, it was so focused on the Middle East.
Yeah, it was astonishing. You know, as someone who has reported from so many countries over the years, again, I think, to the outside world, they would look at last night. And even though Barack Obama is still, you know, quite popular in the rest of the world, they would look at last night and say, geez, it's the United States again. They've got their blinkered vision about whatever matters to them, and that's what they're going to talk about. And of course, the other thing is that, you know, this presumption that the United States must be the leader. We are the ones who have to be strongest. We're the ones that are going to impose our will overseas. And so, yeah, you've got this blinkered attitude, not just with Latin America. To me, I mean, Africa, you're leaving out Africa or even in Pakistan. They did talk a lot about Pakistan. But if you're going to talk about Pakistan, you cannot be serious if you're not also aware that, for example, 2 years ago, climate change helped create a terrible humanitarian disaster there. Monsoon rains, 14 million people left homeless in Pakistan. You don't think that that creates an opportunity for Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups? And yet we don't talk about that because it doesn't fit the ideological presumptions of official Washington.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for joining us again, Mark.
My pleasure, Rose.
Thank you. That's Mark Hertzgard, author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, fellow of the New America Foundation and the nation's environmental correspondent. And we are still joined by Muin Rabbani, independent Middle East analyst, and Aman Jordan, and Mansour Farhang, professor of international relations at Bennington College in Vermont. And we've got just over 10 minutes left. We have one line open if you'd like to join us. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on last night's debate? What was missing? That's also just as telling as what was asked. What would a real debate on U.S. foreign policy look like? And what did last night really tell you about where we're going? 866-798-8255. You can leave a comment on our website or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ali in San Francisco. Hi, Ali. Ali's question was, for both of you, what do you mean when you say that the Middle East will be stable? Mansoor, what do you mean by the word stable?
Stable from whose perspective? Stable means if there is an end to political violence and there is political legitimacy, there is popular sovereignty, and there is majority rule. If the countries are going to be ruled by democratic norms, then gradually they could create the kind of stability that comes from institutionalization of democratic norms. At the present time, the Middle Eastern countries are going through a transition. And like other transitions from traditional or autocratic political orders into a democratic political order, every country where this transition happened, it takes time, it's very disruptive, sometimes it's violent, and because it's not simply changing the structures of government, we also need to change the functions and the perceptions and the behavior patterns of the society. It has to do with political culture. Middle Eastern countries are going through that transition. We are not going to see a stability in the sense that their policy orientation or decisions are completely predictable and there is consensus or the rule of law has been established. It takes time. From the perspective of the United States, the stability means the ability of government to silence dissent and submit to American hegemony in the region. Mm-hmm. This is not stability. This is coercion. This is what existed in Libya. And the Libya, and as well as in Egypt, and other dictatorial states. Mm-hmm. So the definition of stability has to do with what we expect from the state and what we expect from the system of governance in that society.
And Muin, what would you add to that briefly?
Yeah, I never said the Middle East would be stable, but other than that, I don't really have much to add to what's already been said.
All right, well, thank you for the question, Ali. Let's go next to Shoket in Berkeley. Hi, Shoket, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much. First of all, thank you for your program and having some people that have some knowledge and political sense.
Thank you.
I will definitely not vote for President Obama, unfortunately, or fortunately. I think the greatest threat to our national security is this lack of political discussion and having some alternatives that make sense in this very troubled world.
Does that mean you're going for a third party candidate, Shoket?
Well, as I mentioned, there's not much hope for a third party candidate, but we certainly have to look for alternatives. Mm. We have to find some way of getting out of this mess that we're in.
Well, thank you. I'm hearing that a lot in social media, that we need an alternative, because last night was very telling. And again, we are going to have a conversation about this very issue, who you're voting for during election week. So thank you for the phone call. We have an email from a listener who says, last night's debate was shameful. Both candidates talked about Iran as if it were a giant lizard. Both strove to outdo each other on how they would cripple Iran with no mention of human beings, the Iranian people. What other Nobel Peace Prize laureate brags about how many people they kill with extrajudicial assassinations? What were your thoughts about that, Mansoor, just about how the people on the receiving end of U.S. foreign policy were missing from the debate?
But always, people are missing. Even when the United States was supporting the dictatorial states, the people were missing. They didn't really count, and today they don't count. I think the criticism of the debate should be extended to the criticism of mainstream journalism. Mm. That your previous guest referred to Sandy Crowley as asking good questions. The reason was that the questions came from an audience. While in the case of Bob Schieffer, he is the only one who raised the question, and he really represented mainstream journalism, which means everything is about America. Nothing matters except what interests America. The questions were framed in such a way that the rest of the humanity, they don't really matter, and particularly people in the Middle East. When we criticize the debate, we should not limit our criticism only to the to Romney and Obama, but also to the mainstream journalism represented and personified by Bob Schieffer.
Yeah, we're getting a lot of criticism again of Bob Schieffer. In fact, at one point, many on social media thought he disappeared because Mitt Romney was interrupting many times and really taking the conversation to so many different topics, education, jobs, really focusing on domestic policies. So we're hearing that loudly and clearly. And I want to read a few emails. Laura writes in and says, the unnamed presence in the room in last night's debate is the Tea Party. Yes, the majority of Americans support doing something about climate change, but the Tea Party thinks it's bogus, and because of this, the candidates cannot dare bring it up and hope to be elected. The Tea Party has a huge influence on the welfare of the country because they're loud and they dovetail with the agenda of our corporate polluters, and they are relentlessly organized. It's useless to berate Obama. Where are we? The Tea Party worked for years to take over the Republicans, to place radicals in Congress, to put people on school boards. Did we? No, street demonstrations are not enough. Third parties only hurt Obama. Thank you for the email. We have another email from a listener who says, what about the drug war? That wasn't brought up last night, and it's not brought up during the debates. Apparently, it's not relevant to anyone. Well, thank you for the email, Matthew. I'm sure it's relevant to a lot of people, but it's not being brought up, and we will hopefully discuss that on our show on Friday. So thank you for the email, and we have just a couple minutes left. You can email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also give us a call, 866-798-8255, and let's go to our next caller. Do we have a caller?
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
What's your name?
Ed in Berkeley.
Hi, Ed. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I am trying to unsupport the Tea Party so that the Republicans crash, they leave their hold off of the Republican Party so that we can pour over the remnants of that party and support an alternative to the Democrats, who are the people for capitalism and autocracy around the world.
Okay, so what is your solution to this?
To support the antithesis of the Tea Party so that we can take back the Republican Party so we have an alternative to the Democrats.
Well, interesting idea. Thank you for
thank you for
calling in. Mansoor, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, we're getting a lot of emails about supporting Obama versus third parties.
But this is, you know, a dilemma that often we are faced in American elections, that you have the choice between voting for the lesser of two evils when it comes to foreign policy issues. I don't see much of a difference between the two, but when I think about Supreme Court appointees, when I think about social issues, when I think about gay rights, when I think about same-sex marriage, fundamentally, when I think about at least human rights from certain perspectives, still, I prefer Obama to Romney. But when I think about foreign policy, which is so important in American politics and so important to the rest of the world, this is really depressing that there isn't much of a difference between the two. So many voters in the country feel this way and end up closing their eyes and voting for Obama because they think, at least on the social issues and Supreme Court appointees, we are going to have a better chance of getting some decency.
And Muin, you're in Amman. We're ending in just a couple minutes. Before we do, what does this all look like in Amman? And are these debates getting much attention in the Middle East press?
They're being covered as news items, obviously, given that you have presidential elections in the most powerful country in the world. But not much interest beyond that, and for precisely these reasons, that there's, at least when it comes to foreign policy, there's very little to differentiate these candidates. And, you know, we shouldn't focus so much on individuals. I think U.S. foreign policy is very much something that's formulated by institutions and so on. And there's been huge amounts of continuity more than anything else in U.S. foreign policy. So if you look at the transition, for example, from Clinton to Bush and then from Bush to Obama. If you look at something like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or, you know, support for dictators in the region and so on, there's been virtually no change. You know, and in that respect, at least, I don't want to get into the domestic issues in the U.S., but on that issue, at least, I don't see that there's going to be really any substantial difference, regardless of who wins the elections next month.
So you believe that the policies that are in place now will continue and not much change in the next four years?
Yes, I mean, if you look at something like the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq, I mean, you know, it's not really Obama's brainchild or a distinctive Obama policy. You know, Bush signed the withdrawal agreement at the time already with the Iraqi government, and okay, Obama may have sped it up a bit or so on, but you know, there has been, at least in this region, there hasn't been any radical change, of course, in U.S. foreign policy, or often not even a visible change, simply because one occupant leaves the White House and is replaced by someone from a different party. And I think, you know, this goes back to the issue of how similar really the two parties are. Certainly if you compare it, for example, to any Western European country where there are real and substantial differences.
Well, right,
on foreign as well as domestic.
And Europe was also missing from last night's debate. Well, thank you. And I also want to let listeners know we are trying to get third-party candidates on the show. Hopefully we'll be able to do that before the election. Moeen Rabbani is an independent Middle East analyst, contributing editor to the Middle East Report. Mansour Farhang is professor of international relations at Bennington College. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you, and thank you for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. What does the reality of our public hospitals, the last resort for the poor and uninsured, tell us about our healthcare system and our society? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Peter Nix, maker of the new film, The Waiting Room, about a day in the life of Oakland's Highland Hospital. Mitt Romney has said the ER will provide healthcare for those without insurance, but what's the reality of the public ER? If you've spent time at Highland or any other public hospital, what was your experience? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.